no matter what they say, they can't change the truth. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. Along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Good to be back with you in the studio. We've been running some Camp American lectures when we can't get in here, and things do get busy, don't they?
They do, and I actually was able to get on a boat and find my way up the river here and get here in the studio this week. I want to apologize to our listeners. I've had quite a weird schedule the last couple of weeks, and we've not really been able to get in here and do some recording. But today's a little bit different day. We've got some time. And, Chuck, it isn't like that we missed probably the two most shall we say, hot-button issue weeks that there was out there when we were off. But we're going to be talking about those things, well, at least one of them today, because I think it's going to take our entire hour here, to discuss this particular issue. It's one that people now know about. And, you know, in one sense, I am kind of glad we've waited a little bit, because I like seeing how things start shaking out.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it's better.
Seeing how others are parsing it. And then also looking at what some of the, and usually within a 2 to 3 week period, you don't see too many of the ancillary issues that spring up around an issue like this. But we're now seeing them because they're coming at us fast and furious. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what we're talking about here, if nobody's surprised, is the United States Supreme Court's ruling, and I should say diktat, forcing all 50 states in the union to recognize and provide for homosexual couples to be joined in wedlock. Well, now, I'm saying it that way, Chuck, because there is no such thing, the truth, there is no such thing as marriage among people of the same sex, because marriage isn't a social construct. Marriage is a ordinance of God found in his word,
right,
specifically delineated in the book of Genesis, and then as we see throughout the scriptures, fleshed out in much work, especially in the gospels and in the Pauline epistles, of what marriage is supposed to be. Because marriage is supposed to be a reflection, imperfect as it is, and everybody will agree with me that our marriages are not perfect.
Yeah.
But marriage is supposed to be a reflection of the bride's relationship to the groom, i.e. Jesus Christ, and the bride being his church. That's what marriage is. It's actually a reflection of how Christ loves the church, how the husband loves the wife or the bride. I know good friends of mine who, after 20-plus years of marriage, still refers to his wife as his bride, which I think is fantastic, you know, in a emotional, spiritual sense, and also in a biblical sense, because I think that's really what we should do.
Well, yeah, the problem is that it, according to the normal definition, it's not correct.
But there we go. That, and thank you for saying it that way, Chuck, the normal definition.
Yeah.
Chuck, there is no normal anymore. Well, that's our problem.
And that's exactly the point of this whole mess. The fact is that we, and I think you and I have discussed this just a little bit. Someone asked me what I thought about this, and I said, this is the official end of the republic.
I like how you use the term official.
Right.
Because this republic ended a long time ago. It's just we finally now have what we would consider to be universal understanding of the fact.
Yeah. Now, why I say that? Well, a republic, by definition, is rule by a standard of law.
Yes.
And generally through representatives. Great Britain has been a republic since the advent of Parliament. Since it had a legislature and it no longer, and in fact, Britain before the invasion in 1066 was also a republic, because they had a they had a legislature, more or less, and the king was elected. Okay, what does that mean? Well, it means they had a standard of law, and the king was below the law. That's the whole idea behind the Magna Carta, which, by the way, while we were at Camp American, we went through the 800th anniversary of the Magna Carta.
That is correct.
And that would have been June 15th, 1215. So that's 800 years. Now, what does that all mean? It means that from somewhere, there is a standard of law that's higher than any earthly ruler. Which means that the rule comes from somewhere abstract, somewhere not necessarily concrete, and that is from God. Now, we know from our Institute on the Constitution class, what's the famous statement about government? There is a God, our rights come from Him, and the purpose of government is to protect those rights. Now, when we hear that, for instance, one of the things I looked up, was Supreme Court ruling makes same-sex marriage a right.
Actually, no, because our rights are not derived from the Supreme Court of the United States, and neither is that their constitutional jurisdiction is to determine rights.
Exactly. All they can do is hand out a privilege.
They can't even do that, Charles. All they can do, specifically constitutionally, and this is where you're right, this is the official end of our republic because it died a long time ago, especially coming from the Reconstruction era on up, and specifically in the 1930s with the court packing issues, we have had a Supreme Court who has redefined their proper role in our constitutional republic as being one of lawgiver, not of interpreter of whether or not a law fits within the bounds of the Constitution, i.e., is that a law that Congress can legitimately make under their enumerated powers? Is it a law that is allowed to be made or enforced in the way it's enforced under both those legislative powers of Congress? And that's the only branch that has legislative power, and under the enforcement actions of the executive branch. Is it one that, because of the expansion of control by the centralized government under the 14th Amendment, and this is where we get into our recent decision here, the Obergefell decision.
Right.
Does the 14th Amendment really allow the Constitution to be stretched like a rubber band in the way that it has been in order to take a local decision and then reapply it, overturning state after state after state's own decisions, including voter-passed amendments to their constitutions, voter referendums, etc.? Honestly, if we believe that we are a nation of the people, by the people, and for the people, as many would quote both our Constitution and former President Lincoln in his address, we would have to say that we are no longer a nation of the people, by the people, and for the people, because we are now a nation of the judges, by the judges, and for a 5-4 majority.
Well, I'm looking for a quote, and I will come up with it.
That's fine. You keep looking at it. I'm on a roll here.
Well, go for it, because it's important. But we need to get the idea in mind that the reason we're at the end of the republic is that the job of Congress and any legislature is not to make law. It's to discover law.
Really, it is. It's to discover law, because law has already been made by God. And that was an interesting point. You brought up the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta.
Yes.
That was a big point in Magna Carta as well, is that the nobles were asking King John, or demanding King John, recognize the natural law. Recognize that law is not at his fiat and he's not God who can make law, but recognizing that there was an authority above even the king whose laws were for all men and whose laws should be binding the consciences of all, whether they be serf, noble, or regal. Now, in this country, we supposedly don't have a king. Thanks, but no thanks, Alexander Hamilton. We didn't want a king, or John Adams, either one. But what we have here is a situation where the delicate check and balances in our constitutional form of government to allow certain enumerated powers of each branch and having slight checks on those. And I will say slight because they're not supposed to be all-encompassing dead stops. They're supposed to be corrective measures. If a Congress runs out from under their authority and legislates things that they don't have a enumerated right to legislate or aren't bound, those issues are not prevented by the state legislatures to do, the Supreme Court steps in at that point and says, Congress, you can't do this. You know, this is reserved to the states or to the people. Or Congress, you can't do this because it goes beyond your enumerated powers. But what we've had in the modern era is a court who, drunk on its own power, has decided that if Congress won't do something or doesn't frame it in certain language, thank you, John Roberts, then we can reinterpret the language in order to give the power to Congress, even if the Constitution itself is either silent to it or specifically prohibits them from taking the authority. That's the problem we have, Charles. I mean, it isn't so much that, you know, folks would be, you know, crying, oh, if we just got the right president and he picks a couple more justices, everything's going to be okay again. The problem has been and will continue to be that we now are under a different form of governance. We are now under an oligarchy. We have a titular head of a president who is now legislating by executive order and creating issues with that, trying to operate as a sole authority. We have a court, specifically usually a 5 or 6 member majority of that 9-member body, acting as an oligarchy who's determining what we as a people will and won't accept in this culture by their own fiat. And then we have 535 members of Congress who supposedly all lawmaking authority, all legislative authority is supposed to be vested in them, but who on almost a daily basis now cede that authority and abrogate their responsibilities by handing it over to the executive branch or the courts, or using the executive branch and the courts as easy foils and excuses
exactly
for why they're not doing their job.
Okay, I've got two things on that. And the one thing is, I'm going to give you a quote from James Otis, and this is the most important the most important founder you never heard of.
Absolutely. Closely secondly followed by George Mason.
And James Otis was one of those guys who would have made a much bigger splash, but he had his head caved in by a customs official who didn't like what he said. And after that, he was not the same. However, he made a very important contribution to the to the independence movement, and he made gave a quote it's in a pamphlet they wrote called "The Rights of the British Colonies Asserted and Proved," and written in 1763. This is right around the time of the Stamp Act and the all the abominations that came around with that particular tax. He wrote it to oppose the writs of assistance. Now, if you don't know what the writs of assistance is, folks, they're coming back. The writs of assistance are essentially search warrants that the regulatory agents themselves make out and sign. In other words, it doesn't have to go through a judge to approve. They just simply hand you an inspection form, and they have the same power as a search warrant.
Yes.
Okay. Here's what James Otis said about legislatures. Quote, "To say the Parliament is absolute and arbitrary is a contradiction. The Parliament cannot make 2 and 2 5. Omnipotency cannot do it. The supreme power in a state is jus dicere, to declare what the law is only. Jus dare, to make law, strictly speaking, belongs alone to God."
Amen.
"Parliaments are in all cases to declare what is. Parliament that makes it so. There must be, in every case, a higher authority, viz. God.
Mm-hmm.
Should an act of Parliament be against any of his natural laws, which are immutably true, their declaration would be contrary to eternal truth, equity, and justice, and consequently void. And so it would be adjudged by the Parliament itself when convinced of their mistake. Upon this great principle, parliaments repeal such acts as soon as they find they have been mistaken in having declared them to be for the public good when in fact they are not so. End quote.
Sometimes we have to go back and think of the wisdom of some of our forgotten founders, because these men, by and large, were putting their lives on the line when they wrote these type of things, because that was sedition against the crown. And that was punishable as treason. So James Otis, Samuel Adams, others, you know, I think we take our founding era a little too lightly, because I think we think that, hey, these guys were just all blogging or writing letters to each other and you know, getting everybody riled up, and then that was the only issue to it. But really, these issues, Charles, were more than just principles.
Right.
They were matters of life and death. They were matters of the highest order principle, and that was their duty before God to obey him.
Well, if you didn't, let's go to the second part of my statement. You know, I said that there were two parts of that I wanted to hit on. If you'll recall, when some of this came up, and Mitch McConnell was asked about what he was going to do to roll back gay marriage, mm-hmm. what did he say? You sent me an article that basically says Congress can't roll back gay marriage.
And he's absolutely incorrect.
He is
matter.
Absolutely wrong, which, as we've just stated, is a lie. And the reason it's a lie is Article 3 of the Constitution.
Absolutely.
Because it's difficult to for most people to see, because they've been brought up during this era when we have this idea that... Well, once the Supreme Court speaks, well, that's it. That's the law of the land. Well, there are major problems with that.
May I direct your attention and our listeners' attention for just a moment to a different section of the United States Constitution? That would be one Article 6 of the Constitution.
Yes.
What is normally called the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, at least the first half of it is. And Charles, you know, because you mentioned this whole idea about this, you know, making a Supreme Court decision the law of the land. Well, it's funny, because that phrase actually is kind of embedded in the Article 6 of the Constitution, where it says, and I quote in part, "This Constitution and the laws of the United States made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made under the authority of the United States, are the supreme law of the land." Chuck, did you hear United States Supreme Court decisions in that?
No.
Okay. Does the United States Supreme Court make the Constitution?
No.
Okay, no, because they're an entity within the Constitution. They're bound by it. They're under
the Constitution.
Okay. Does the Supreme Court make laws? No, as we've said, and even Congress really doesn't, but Article 1, Section 1 of the United States Constitution specifically states that all legislative authority herein granted, herein means in this Constitution,
right.
Granted means you're being given the authority by somebody else who has the authority. Herein granted is vested in a Congress of the United States consisting of a House of Representatives and a Senate. Folks, did you hear Supreme Court in there as part of the Congress? No. All legislative authority means all lawmaking.
Right.
So it's only Congress, the House and the Senate, who can make laws. So, okay, so the second tier of the supreme law of the land isn't in the court's purview, and all treaties made under the authority of the United States. Well, Chuck, first of all, who gets into treaties? Which branch?
Well, the executive negotiates them.
Exactly.
And the Senate approves them.
And the legislative branch approves right. them, at least one chamber of the legislative branch. Did you hear the Supreme Court in there anywhere?
Nowhere.
Okay, now let me reiterate Article 6 once again, because words do matter. This Constitution and the laws of the United States made in pursuance thereof and treaties made under the authority of the United States are the supreme law of the land. So, folks, when you hear this chestnut about a Supreme Court diktat becoming the law of the land, unquote, what you're hearing is a politician who's trying to avoid the responsibility. And you know what? You should run the bum completely out of office without hesitation. Because that means, number one, he doesn't understand the Constitution. Or number two, he hopes you're an idiot.
Right. He hopes, he basically hopes that the, essentially the awful public school and college education that you got on government.
That you never did get past the, singing the Schoolhouse Rock version of the preamble of the Constitution. That's the only thing you know.
I am still just a bill.
Yeah. There's that too. But I know everybody remembers the, you know, we the people in order to form a more perfect I'm not going to punish people with my singing. But the key is
I'm sure I can find the YouTube for that and maybe we'll attach it to the bottom of the post. Absolutely. When we post it.
But one thing that most people, Chuck, aren't aware of is that the court's responsibility, even under Article 6, is to only determine the constitutionality of those laws and those treaties.
That's okay. I'm at Article 3, Section 2.
Please, we'll get right back to what you were saying.
This is right back. Okay, we just came full circle back to what we were talking about. All legislative authority is in the Congress.
Right.
And the judicial authority is limited. Here it is. This is the most important part of Article 3, in my opinion. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity. What does equity mean? Everybody says this is their rubber stamp. This is the elastic clause. No. Equity means the equitable application of the law. In other words, case law. Not overturning specific law, it's application of case law. What does that mean? That case law applies to the litigants only, not to general cases. Okay. The judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority. To all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls. To all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. To controversies to which the United States shall be a party. To controversies between two or more states. This part has been amended out. Between a state and citizens of another state. That's not allowed anymore by Amendment 11. Between citizens of different states, between citizens of the same state claiming lands under grants of different states, and between a state or the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens, or subjects. In all cases affecting ambassadors, other public ministers, and consuls, and in those in which a state shall be party, the Supreme Court shall have original jurisdiction.
Now, that's a key phrase.
It is. That means it doesn't have to go through the appellate process or the circuit or a court of appeals. That means the Supreme Court hears the case.
Now, let me stop you right there because you used a inartful turn of phrase that has caused a great deal of problem. You said they don't have to go through the appellate court.
Well, what I mean is
that by the Constitution, they are prohibited from those cases starting anywhere except the United States Supreme Court.
And that's what I meant. And thank you for that. It was inartful.
Oh, no, and I'm not trying to get on you.
No, you're right.
But the problem is even justices of our own United States Supreme Court have used that wiggle room to deny hearing cases that the Constitution says they have original jurisdiction over.
You mean like when the attorneys general sued the federal government over Obamacare?
That's exactly the one I'm talking about. That would be the Cuccinelli case coming out of Virginia.
Exactly.
And the one coming out of Arizona. There were two different cases that both, because it was in the purview of that original jurisdiction language, were filed with the United States Supreme Court, and the court refused to accept them and required them to send them down to the district court level, which, Chuck, should have been grounds for impeachment of the Chief Justice of the United States.
Absolutely. Absolutely it should have been grounds, because the constitutional language is absolutely crystal clear.
Well, it's only crystal clear if you're not a postmodernist. Oh.
And which is part of our problem. Okay, so we've basically, in all the other cases before mentioned, all those ones that were in the primary list in the first paragraph I mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction, both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. That's the money quote.
Yes, it is.
In other words, how many times have you heard that to, for instance, get prayer back in public school, or to have to outlaw flag burning, blah, blah, blah. We need a federal amendment to the Constitution because the Supreme Court says so.
Oh, I've heard it time and time again, and each time I roll my eyes.
And what does this clause in Article 3, Section 2 do to that argument?
Totally puts a torpedo right through the hull under the waterline.
It's eviscerated, because what this says is that Congress can pass a law that says under Article 10 of the Bill of Rights, those powers are returned back to the state. Again, this would work for abortion as well. And we've talked to a number of people who were in the abortion movement about this, and everybody goes, well, you can't do it that way. Well, if we're following the Constitution, we can do it that way. So what would happen? Congress mm-hmm. would pass a bill that says all those things are returned back to the states, and they can do what's called jurisdiction stripping, because under that particular clause, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. All they have to do is to put in a clause that says the Supreme Court or any federal court shall have no jurisdiction in this case. Now, has this ever been done? You know, they tell us it can't be done. Has it ever been done? Oh, you bet it has. And it frustrates the court no end. There was a case in the late 19th century where just such a thing happened. And a case was brought before the Supreme Court. And you can hear the vitriol dripping from the pen of the justice who penned the opinion, where they said, we're not allowed to hear this case.
Exactly.
Because it was restricted from our jurisdiction by Congress.
Exactly.
And they hate it. Now, has it been used recently? Yes, 20 years ago. Was used in a law written by Tom Daschle, and it was on a forestry bill. And what it did was it restricted certain things going on in national forests under the jurisdiction of the state of North Dakota. And it restricted...
South Dakota, actually.
South Dakota.
Daschle's from South Dakota.
Yeah, pardon me.
That's okay.
I have a friend who's from North Dakota, and I kind of have it on the brain.
Okay.
Daschle restricted any federal court action on what was being done on this land in a national forest in South Dakota. And the courts, somebody tried to bring a suit, and the court said, we can't hear it. We've been stripped of the jurisdiction. So can it be done? Yes, because this is not one of those original jurisdiction cases. Now, can Congress strip out the court's ability to hear cases on their original jurisdiction? No.
No, not at all.
No, and that's the whole point of this clause. The Supremes have that. Now, what does that mean? That means that, guess what? Congress doesn't create rights, and they certainly don't create laws. And they can be restricted. So what is it? I'm going to play this thing from Mitch McConnell, and thing is probably the best name for it.
Worry about at this point is the potential problems with regard to religious liberty. There are a number of institutions which, in practicing their religion, may run up against this, so we're going to have a lot of additional litigation as this decision is weighed against strongly held religious beliefs of a number of Americans. So we'll have a whole new line of litigation.
And the real problem here is that it's meaningless.
In the labor market.
That's a meaningless statement. Okay, we're going to see what we can do to protect religious groups. And what will happen? Because McConnell is unwilling to do jurisdiction stripping, the Supreme Court will simply rule them out of order. So let's say that we pass legislation at the state or federal level that protects pastors, protects churches, protects businesses from having to engage in things that are an abomination to God, engage in honoring things like weddings.
Yes.
What will happen? Well, the Supreme Court will simply say, nope, under the 14th Amendment, you can't do that. There's an excellent piece I listened to the other day, Tom Woods, who the politically incorrect guide to history. He's a professor of history. He's an author. He's written some great books, Nullification, several books that I have read. And he had a fellow by the name of Kevin Gutzman. And Kevin Gutzman actually wrote the politically incorrect guide to the Constitution. And Gutzman and Tom Woods, and I will put up a link to this, discussed what the 14th Amendment actually meant when it was written. And it was not written to do the things that it's doing now. It was essentially written to make certain that the clauses in Article 4 of the Constitution were obeyed. And that was to make certain that every state had a Republican form of government. And what does that mean? The rule of law means that every citizen is given the same treatment because what was happening in the South after the war. Former slaves were being treated as semi-citizens.
Mm-hmm.
They were not allowed to engage in contracts. They were not allowed to vote in some cases. There were all kinds of things they weren't allowed to do. Well, the 14th Amendment was passed to ensure that the states treated former slaves as equals under the law.
Correct.
That's not a bad thing. The problem is it was so inartfully and poorly designed and worded that what it did was it basically turned every bit of power that remained with the states over to the federal government, and specifically to the courts. And in a book by a guy named Raoul Berger, he talked about it. It was a Rule by Judiciary was the name of the book, if I remember right. And it's the history of the 14th Amendment. Great book. I have a copy. Everybody should have a copy. Raoul Berger, keep that in mind. And they Gutzman and Woods mentioned that in that clip. So what have we got here? We've got an oligarchy run amok. And when I said we were at the end of the republic, what I meant was the fact that we are now ruled. We are no longer ruled by law written under a higher authority, that is God's law.
Right.
We are now ruled by the will and whim of 9 oligarchs. Because Congress passes a law and it believes the law to be correct, or our state legislatures pass a law and it believes those laws to be correct, and the Supreme Court swoops in and says, you know, that really bothers me. I knew somebody in college that was different than that, or did something that I think is okay, even though you may find it disgusting. I find it fine. And so they come through and wipe those laws out, a power that they have never had. It's not given to them constitutionally.
No.
It is a usurped power. So therefore, we are ruled by an oligarchy.
Right. And how's that going to turn out? You know, Chuck, we had a 5-4 decision in the Obergefell case that basically mandated recognition, acceptance, and endorsement of these so-called unions throughout the 50 states. But we have what I would consider different ways of resisting that order by the oligarchs. As a matter of fact, here in Ohio, we've got a couple things going on. We've had one group, and most of our listeners, you know, if they're tied in at all, have probably seen these calls to action that are coming from various quadrants,
right,
to contact the Ohio Attorney General and ask him to file a motion for rehearing of the case because Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Justice, I think, Elena Kagan both have officiated same-sex ceremonies and did so between the arguments and between the release of the decision. So therefore they would say that you know, these things were caused them to be unfit for hearing the case.
Because in other words, they had proven that they were
they had a conflict of interest. They were not impartial.
They were not impartial. Right.
But I have to say then, Chuck, and there's three different things on this, and you know, I bless my our friends out there who are trying whatever they can do. But I think this strategy is horribly flawed, and I'll tell you why. Number one, if that's the case, then every married justice would have to recuse themselves. Because wouldn't they be biased the other direction? If they're married to a spouse of the opposite sex. Where are we going to find nine justices who are impartial on this issue?
David Souter, maybe?
Maybe. Who knows? So I think that there's a flaw there. But I think a bigger flaw is that it's my understanding that the attorneys general in the four states in the Sixth Circuit knew about these conflicts prior to the arguments.
Oh, sure they did.
They knew where these justices stood. If their staffs are any, you know, smart at all, they would have researched where they thought everybody was going to be at in order to frame their arguments. Is there a window to ask for a motion for reconsideration? Sure there is. Should they do it? Why not? You know, you're probably just going to get told no, but file the motion anyway. You know, do whatever you can do to keep things in flux for a while, if you know what I'm saying. But the third biggest problem with this issue is that what change will it make? Because what will happen, and we've discussed this a couple of times earlier today before we got on air,
right.
And that is the fact that even if you get the two justices to be recused and you have a rehearing on this case, the standard is going to be that the two would have to recuse, and you don't get it down to seven and then have a 4-3 decision the other way. It doesn't work that way. You would have two justices that would be two judges of the circuit courts who would be asked to come and sit on the case, and it would come out of the same circuits. I believe this to be the case. They would come out of the same circuits as those justices have authority over or oversight over, because all of the circuits in the United States, including the D.C. Circuit, have what they call judges who are supervising those circuits, the justices. Now, in the case of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I think we saw that her circuit is the Second Circuit, which is up in New York, Vermont, and Connecticut. How many conservative pro-marriage justices are you going to get out of Vermont and Connecticut
or
New York?
You're not. Well, look, that's a throwback to the old days when when Supreme Court justices actually rode circuit.
Rode circuit. That's right. That was back when they did that. And Elena Kagan, she covers two circuits, the Sixth and the Seventh. Oh, the Sixth Circuit, we can get Jeff Sutton. No, see, that's the problem. The case that they're hearing came out of the Sixth Circuit, so they would not have any of the judges from the Sixth Circuit here sitting to hear the case coming out of their own circuit. It would come from the Seventh Circuit. Now, the Seventh Circuit is just about as liberal as the Second Circuit. So really what you would end up having, probably, is the same 5-4 decision.
I was going to say, what's going to change?
Not much.
Not much.
And faces in the seats.
And I will give Mike DeWine a pass on just a small pass.
Okay, we'll give him a little bit of a pass.
He knows that's the case.
And I think that's the reason why he realizes that, honestly, why waste the
political capital
time? Well, political capital, taxpayer resources, time, etc., to do something that you know isn't going to change the outcome.
Right. Nothing's going to change.
Now, there are a couple things that are happening that could change the outcome. Well, it could change the way we accept the quote-unquote law of the land being given to us by the oligarchs,
yes,
by the five. And the first case is in Toledo, okay? I'm going to be looking across the country, but the first case is in Toledo, where we have a judge, a Toledo Municipal Court judge, who has decided that he cannot, in good conscience, because of his Christian faith, officiate at same-sex unions. And I'm not going to call it, because I don't care what the Supreme Court called it, it's not a marriage. And this, they have to basically, they do on rotation. All the municipal court judges in Toledo have a three-week rotation where they have to stand for what they call civil ceremony duty. In other words, when people come to go to, used to be a justice of the peace, it's now a municipal court judge, to get married outside the church, they come to the judges to get married. And Judge Alan McConnell, who is an African-American justice, who's he's a registered Democrat as well, and a former leader in the Toledo chapter of the NAACP, basically said, no, I'm not doing it. Find somebody else. And they did. This was a lesbian couple, and he basically said, no, I'm not going to do this. They got another judge, another municipal judge, and they got what they wanted. But he stood up. He said, I cannot do this. And he basically said that, you know, here, you know what? I have to stand on what I believe. And he says the civil rights struggle is what inspired his career. And he says, quote, on Monday, July the 6th, I declined to marry a non-traditional couple during my duties assignment. The declination was based upon my personal and Christian beliefs established over many years. I apologize to the couple for the delay they experience and wish them the best, unquote. Chuck, that's called legitimate civil disobedience as a believer. And frankly, it didn't really hurt anything, but the left now is screaming for him to be impeached, for him to be removed from the bench. Now, as a municipal court judge, that's most likely going to be the city of Toledo. Although I believe the governor might actually, I don't think he appoints at municipal level, but I'm thinking it's
no,
the mayor.
No, those are elected.
Yeah, it'd be the mayor of Toledo who would have to appoint.
Now, because it's an elected post?
If it's in the middle of a term, I think that the executive has the ability to appoint in lieu of the next term coming.
Yeah, but I think they have to be recalled rather than impeached.
Right, probably recalled. Okay. So basically, we want to stand with Judge McConnell, and I think many people should, because here's a man of conscience and conviction who says, listen, I'm just not going to do it, period. So much for law of the land, Chuck.
Okay, I'm going to point out something that some people might want to kick me for, and that's fine.
I'm going to go right ahead.
My shins are all marked up already anyway.
I'm not going to kick
this
you.
This is a judge of color. Who is an NAACP leader.
Right.
Who is engaging in nullification.
Nullification. Absolutely. That's exactly what this is.
And if you told him he was engaging in nullification, he would probably have a stroke.
I doubt it, seriously. I do believe this judge knows exactly what he's doing. I believe he understands it fully.
You don't think he'd walk away from that label? Because that's what it is. It's nullification.
The point is that labels being what they are, most people don't even understand what
word
means.
What nullification means, yeah.
Okay. Now, here's the other aspect of this. Now, I want to get into nullification in a minute if we have time. But I want to talk about this real quick. Because this is coming from SCOTUS blog, which is the blog of the Supreme Court. This was posted up here just about a week ago. Actually, just about a week ago, by a reporter by the name of Lyle Denniston. And it's titled, A Plea to Resist the Court on Same-Sex Marriage. And he is reporting about a couple of groups, actually, in the state of Alabama. Now, Alabama is near and dear to our hearts, Charles, because we happen to personally know the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court.
Yes, we do.
One Roy Moore. And so basically, these advocacy groups in the state have basically said, hey, you know, the court needs to refuse to accept what the justices have done, i.e. nullification. And that the Supreme Court of the state of Alabama. Now, the Supreme Court is the one who asked these groups for input. So Roy Moore and his colleagues, and that's Tom Parker, who's also on that court. I love Tom. Has basically asked these groups to take a look at it. Now, they filed a brief. The Alabama Policy Institute and the Alabama Citizens Action Program, which is a church support group of interdenominational flavor, filed a 33-page brief. And they said that basically that the court has the constitutional power to refuse to accept what the justices have done and a constitutional duty to insulate state officials from legal risk if they do not obey the decision based on a religious objection. They hit both nullification and interposition in one brief.
Which is, and those are outgrowths of one another.
Yes, they are. And so basically, because what you have is that even before the decision came out at the United States Supreme Court in the Obergefell decision, you had the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, one Roy Moore, basically tell the local, I believe it's the probate judges in that state are the only ones it's the probate judges. They're the only officials in the state with the authority to issue marriage license. He basically barred every last one of them under threat of losing their jobs from issuing same-sex marriage licenses as a violation of their oath under the Alabama Constitution before God. Now, I like the way Roy Moore thinks. I'll just tell you that right now. But these organizations put these things out here. And they basically found errors in the majority ruling, which there are tons of. We didn't even get into that in the specifics of the ruling. There are tons of errors. They also looked at the protest, Luther King Jr., against unjust laws, and they found a series of Supreme Court rulings from the state of Wisconsin defying the Supreme Court in a 19th century runaway slave case.
Now, remember I mentioned Tom Woods?
Yes.
Tom Woods wrote that in his book, Nullification.
That's right.
If you get a copy of Nullification, and if I'm not mistaken, if you go to www.principledpolicy.com
and go to our bookstore,
you can buy a copy of Nullification.
That's absolutely right. I think it's in our Amazon store. So basically, they used this whole idea that even at the Wisconsin State Court basically said that, you know what? The Supreme Court can make a ruling, but we don't have to follow it. And they didn't follow it. And to this day, they haven't followed that ruling. And so basically it says, and the quote from the brief says, in the nearly 157 years since the U.S. Supreme Court's purported reversal of two state court rulings, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has never filed or accepted the U.S. Supreme Court's mandates. What the state court did, the brief asserted, was done, quote, in fidelity to the United States Constitution. In other words, if you believe that the diktat of five black robe oligarchs in D.C. have gone against their constitutional authority as a state court, you have the duty to nullify. I think it's absolutely right. Now, those who are great centralists and federalists of all stripes now would scream bloody murder that we would dare presume that states have any power whatsoever. And honestly, if we let this stand, if the states roll over and die on this one, Chuck, you're right. It's the official death of the republic.
Right.
Because at that point, there's no use for a state anymore. There really isn't. All you're doing is you're administering federal rules and federal funds, and in some states now, your law enforcement is being federalized.
Well, and it's the final stake through the heart of the Constitution, because the Constitution is very explicit that we have a divided sovereignty. We do not have an oligarchy. And by a divided sovereignty, I mean there are state jurisdictional things and there are federal jurisdictional things. And guess what? Marriage is a state jurisdictional issue.
Yes, it is.
Which is exactly why when the Supreme Court, if you'll recall, a couple of years ago, and I'm trying to remember exactly when it was, they ruled that the Defense of Marriage Act was unconstitutional. I think that was in 13 or 12, the federal
13.
DOMA. 13. Okay. What they had in effect had done was found that the Article 4 portion of the Constitution, wherein the Senate can set the effect of one state's laws on another one, they deemed that Article 4 was unconstitutional. And so, because if you look at what they said was, it says specifically Congress, not the courts, not the right. not the president,
absolutely.
Has the right to set the limits of one state's laws on another. In other words, Massachusetts can have all the gay marriage it wants. Ohio doesn't have to accept it.
Exactly.
And in fact, what they did was they set the effect of Massachusetts law to zero. Okay, the Supreme Court said, well, you can't do that. Based on the 14th Amendment. Well, did the 14th Amendment repeal the 4th Amendment?
Well, in the justices' minds, of course it did.
Exactly. And this is the problem we're running into now. There's an old saying, and I think it was Charles Evans Hughes, that the Constitution says what the justices say it says.
Right.
And people kind of laughed at that at the time. Well, guess what? We're there.
We are. As a matter of fact, even the laws say what the justices say it is. If you look at John Roberts' two stellar works in the various Obamacare rulings. From the first one to this latest one that came out.
Well, Barry, that's what's the most important thing to think about. Because in the two different rulings, in one, Roberts basically did the Cheshire Cat thing.
A penalty is a tax, not a penalty.
Yes.
We can make it constitutional.
I think it was the Cheshire Cat who said words mean exactly what I want them to mean, no more, no less.
That's
yeah.
right.
That who is to be master, that's all.
Right.
And he did that. He basically made the words mean what he wanted them to mean.
Oh, you're talking about Alice in Wonderland. That was Humpty Dumpty.
Humpty Dumpty. Yes. Yeah, it was Humpty Dumpty. My apologies.
That's all right. To Lewis Carroll.
Classic literature.
Your apologies to Lewis Carroll.
Yeah,
yes.
My classic literature knowledge is not what it should be. Okay. The next day, the ruling comes out for gay marriage. And what does John Roberts say? Do the words not mean things?
Yes.
I mean, he's decrying the fact that the majority, the five members in the majority, have basically twisted the words to mean what they want them to mean.
Which is the same thing he had done in the Obamacare decisions. Two of them, the one that came out the day before, and the other one, the original one that made the thing supposedly made it constitutional in the first place.
But this is individualism run amok. The words mean what I want them to mean,
exactly.
Not what you want them to mean.
Right, that's post-postmodernism.
Yes.
We don't have a universal definition, we just have my definition.
That is when we have withdrawn into individualism to the point where postmodernism basically says that you cannot understand... you can't really understand what another person is saying because communication is essentially impossible because the meanings of words aren't concrete.
To anyone, yes.
They're fluid. So you don't really know what the next person has said. You think you know, but you don't because you implied the interpretation and not that, and you didn't necessarily take on what that person meant. Now we're there. See what it looks like? Is it pretty? Listen, I've been in churches where people were actually talking about how wonderful postmodernism is. Let me tell you something. A strong Christian faith in Jesus Christ is impossible in a postmodern culture.
It's impossible to that culture.
Exactly.
But it is very possible if you reject that culture.
I actually had a pastor in a church I was in say he ached to lead us in a postmodern worship. And I can remember asking him, what would that be? Since nobody knows what anything really means and words don't mean things.
Right.
Well, you mischaracterize. No, I'm not.
That's exactly what the definition of postmodernism is.
Because I've read as much of the literature as I could slog through, and that's not all that much. But I understood the gist of what was being said, and that is that words don't mean things and that we really can't communicate at all. And therefore, God couldn't communicate to us because we look at the words and in our individuality can't understand what he said.
Let me give you a small handful of words here that I think are very important. This is coming out of that brief that I talked about. This was something that in the Alabama, brief, and it says that they said when the federal courts engage in quote unquote unlawful acts, which they're considering the Obergefell decision to be, that state courts have the obligation to resist, even if that sets up quote a collision unquote between state and federal courts. Okay. The brief quoted one of the Wisconsin judge's comments at the time. Now remember, This was in the mid-19th century. This was before postmodernism took over. So listen to these words in a non-postmodern context, because it's very important. Quote, "It is much safer to resist unauthorized and unconstitutional power at its very commencement when it can be done by constitutional means than to wait until the evil is so deeply and firmly rooted that the only remedy is revolution," unquote.
Oof. And folks, revolution is the worst possible thing that could happen. We need to have a quiet revolution. In other words, we need to have a reestablishment of the rule of law.
Absolutely.
And the way to do that is not through revolution. It's through understanding, getting to know what the law is supposed to be, and implementing it.
Absolutely.
And only voting for leaders who understand that and will do everything possible to implement it, who will stand up to leadership in their given legislative or executive branch or judicial branch bodies and say, this far and no further, and we want to take it back to where it's supposed to be. People are always accusing us of being backward. You always want to go back. No, I really love living in the modern age. What I don't like about the modern age is the fact that the cultural things that have happened. There, we can have all these wonderful things. We can have moonshots. We can have cars that can sense cars in front of us and can help us apply the brakes and all these wonderful things without the cultural changes. And some cultural changes we've needed because the church has been guilty of doing a number of things that were not biblical. Okay, fine. Let's admit that. That's going to be the case until Christ comes back. We're constantly going to be having to fight non-biblical thinking in the church. And we're in the midst of it right now.
Yes.
I'm reading Joel McDermott's book, again, Inglorious Kingdoms, which is about the Radical Two Kingdom movement. Because he wrote an excellent article, and again, I'll post a link to it, that said Radical Two Kingdom Advocates, You May Now Kiss Your Bride. And what it basically said was, this is the fallout that you get when you want to go to natural law. If you deny God's law and you go to natural law, which nobody knows what natural law is, then this is the natural outcome. If this is how you want to rule a nation on the basis of natural law, and natural law is essentially majority-based, and in this case, it's not even majority-based. We already know the majority of people are not in favor of homosexual marriage. They're not in favor of a number of things. The problem is that, and we got no time at all to talk about this, but this is merely the fallout. This is one of the things that's a part of a much bigger picture. Now, people are looking at it like, and we've kind of contributed to that by saying this is the end of something. It is the end of something, but as always happens, I had someone yell at me the other day because I was, it was on a different subject. Why are you focusing on these little things and not worrying about the big picture? And I go, do you not understand that the big picture is made of little pieces? Yes. You need to fight every one of the little pieces, and you need to carve out your niche on what you are going to fight about and what you're not.
Yes.
And everybody needs to carve those out so we can get the big picture taken care of. You know, I'll go real quick on this.
Sure.
People were fighting, because we're out of time, were fighting about the whole Confederate flag thing and forgetting what started the whole mess, and it was a mass murder in a church.
Yes.
From by an atheist.
Absolutely.
And where is that fact? That's all buried. We're all talking about the Confederate flag and tearing down Stone Mountain and all kinds of stuff, and we've forgotten that it was an atheist gunman who went into a church, sat there and prayed with the people for half an hour and almost didn't do it because they were so nice to him. And yet he still pulled his gun out and killed 9 people.
Right.
So, things to think about.
And that had nothing to do with a flag or a carving on the side of a hill.
Sure didn't. That being the case, we want you to think about these things. We want to know what you think. Please get in contact with us, www.principledpolicy.com. That's www.principledpolicy.com. We want to know what you think. You can leave a comment out at the site. If you want to catch this again, it will be available on podcast at that website. And we're out of time, so join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.